So are you allowed to have coffee in here? Or? Oh, okay. Oh, okay. There you go.
I can go get you a cup in the hotel. Really good cup.
A cup of what?
Cream.
We'll get an order here, yeah. Seven blacks, three with cream.
That is the definition of a servant.
Is anybody here from Jackson? Good, I can tell a Jackson story then. At Jackson First United Methodist, they have this coffee Nazi person who doesn't allow you to take coffee into the worship center of the sanctuary, you know. And I heard recently a man got a cup of coffee and waltzed right in, and the coffee Nazi nailed him, and it was our new bishop. He was visiting for the first time, told he couldn't have coffee in there. I think she backed down a little bit. That's right. Everybody's the same here, yeah. We're going to jump back into history a little bit today, and but just as a way of setting that up, I've got a good friend, Shane Bishop, who's a pastor in Fairview Heights, Illinois, and he's about my age, and he has a son that's about 21, and he was just telling me recently that his son is not a very good student at all, but he's trying to get some courses at a junior college. And he and Shane were driving to go hunting last fall, and the son was driving the pickup truck. And he said, "Dad, can I stop for a minute at the college? I want to drop off a paper that I had written for Western Civ class." And Shane said, "Oh, what's the paper about?" He goes, "Oh, it's history. It's about Alexander Hamilton." And Shane said, "Oh, I like history. Do you mind if I look at your paper while we're driving?" "Go ahead." The title of the paper was "Why Alexander Hamilton Was the Best President of the United States." And Shane's looking at it and he said, "Son, is it a game changer for you if I tell you he was never president of the United States?" And his kid goes, "Nope." Drops off the paper. So, you know, it doesn't really help to be ignorant of history, does it? What's that? Yeah. Waters World, yeah. Especially with Hamilton the musical. Yeah. Yeah, what a great president he was. Yeah. Well, I just was, you know, and I love the fact that you like to talk back. So let's just talk, and if you have a comment, questions, adults always, we learn better when we talk, don't we? So is it okay if I sit down?
Absolutely.
Okay. So we're going to go back to the 1700s, and this is just a fun fact. It's interesting to me that churches in England in the 1700s had a way of keeping people awake. Did you know that if you snoozed in church, the ushers in the back actually had a long stick, and they were allowed to poke people if they, you know, if they fell asleep. Allegedly, this story is about one guy who sat down, and the preachers, you know, they didn't have videos, they didn't have slides, they didn't have ways to keep your attention, and they preached doctrinal sermons. I mean, it was heavy doctrine for a long time, and this preacher was apparently droning on and on, nothing like what I ever do, of course, but droning on and on and on and on, and this guy started getting sleepy, and he fell asleep. And so the usher just quietly got the long stick, reached up over the rows, and tapped him on the shoulder. Didn't affect him. In fact, he started to snore. He got louder. So the usher, the second time, pushes him in the back. And the guy actually fell forward and continued to snore. And so he was sound asleep. Third time, the usher whacked him on the side of the head from the back. And the guy, without ever opening his eyes, said, "Hit me again. I can still hear him." That's what people are like in my church. Anyway, the Methodist revival the Methodist movement of the 1700s is probably one of the greatest spiritual awakening moments of history. I mean, we know that there's the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 2, when Pentecost comes, that's a great spiritual awakening. Of course, the Holy Spirit comes for the first time. But in history, there are just moments like that. And the 1700s was one of those moments. Two founders of the Methodist movement. Anybody know their names? John and Charles Wesley. Yeah, John was more of the preacher, of course. Charles was also ordained, but he was very right-brained. And he wrote a lot of hymns. Yeah. In fact, he wrote, I think we have saved over 5,000. They think he wrote around 8,000. That's a lot of hymns. You're cranking a couple a day out, you know, man. So what's funny about John Wesley is, by our standards, I stood up beside a life-size statue of him a couple summers ago in England, and he's about this tall. He's 5'4". And so from a little person, dynamic movement of God, you know. And I always say that you can't really predict ministry types. Everybody thinks church planters ought to be these hyperactive, you know, go, 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 go. I'm the exact opposite. And I planted a church and I coach church planters. And I'm the most laid-back person you've ever met, you know. So God uses all kinds of personalities. And even your personality, you think it can't be used by God. You're not. It's not true. God has designed you the way you are. A lot of times people use the word revival, the Methodist revival. And the word revival means a returning to life. So that must mean something happened to the life in the first place. And spiritual life of the church was very, very dead in the 1700s. In fact, Colleen and I, when we first moved to Michigan, we had a farmhouse that was given to us as a parsonage, and it had a Michigan basement. Anybody know what that means? A Michigan basement's about 3/4 length high. I mean, you have to stoop to walk down there. The floor is semi-old concrete, semi-dirt, and that's where they put our washer and dryer. And we had to go down there, you know, to do the laundry. And I remember my 3-year-old nephew one time coming to visit us for the first time. And he walks down the stairs. And he just looks around. He doesn't even want to go down there. And he goes, "This place is a rotten mess." That's probably the best description. That's Epworth, man. Anyway. For about 250 years, the English monarchy was just an absolute mess. Between 1500 and, 1500 and 1750, it was one problem after another. One monarch tried to turn the Church of England back to Catholicism. Then the next one came in, burned up all the crucifixes, and kicked all the Catholics out of the country. You know, it was just like back and forth for about 250 years. So you get to the 1700s, and it's a very, very turbulent time. But just before we jump into that, any comments so far? Any questions about anything? The word revival is not new for Methodists or anybody else. It goes back a long way. In fact, the first revival that we have recorded after the book of Acts, I mean, Acts isn't really a revival. It's the Holy Spirit coming for the first time. The last book of the Bible... where we actually are may not be where, you know, exactly what we want. So that's what's happening in England. I think God sent John Wesley along just in time to mind the gap. Yeah. Okay, how about now? Okay, good. Wesley grew up again in this atmosphere of Epworth. His mom probably had more spiritual influence on him than his dad. She was the original homeschooler, you know, and she had a whole classroom, right? 19 kids. They said when you know, what one of the things he learned from her was the spiritual life. And one of the things that Susanna Wesley did was, because we were in her kitchen, it's very tiny. It's real small. How did she feed people? I don't know. But she could never get alone. So she'd take her again. Yeah. Are you recording this?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So anyway, God, it was like, and so John, I think, learned the importance of that from her. I think he also learned the importance, because this guy persevered through so many things, from his dad. I mean, his dad persevered 40 years through all kinds of people that liked him, didn't like him, and lots of different problems. So Wesley goes off to Oxford. His dad wants to send him to a good education. And he and Charles go to Oxford. And a small group of people who were sort of like-minded, wanting to practice spirituality. So this group of John, Charles, and a few others would get up early every morning, read the Bible, time in prayer, and do works of charity at prisons, homes for all kinds of stuff. The other students started calling them by Holy Club. So that was the first name. You guys are in the Holy Club. And then later people called them enthusiasts. Enthusiast is what we might call fanatic now, or something like that. You know, and a couple of other names were moths. You guys are like drawn to the Bible like moths are drawn to light. People called them madmen. So they had all kinds of names, but the name that finally stuck, Methodists. Why? Because they were methodical in life, right? They had a plan for closing that gap. Yep, do we want to take a look at this?
Yeah, sometimes it's actually this little thing, kip comes off. It has a different, they have different stones, so it might come loose there.
Everybody, this is Greg, and he's looking at the microphone. Does anybody know any of the history, except Melody, you can answer, of how John actually really had a heart experience with Jesus? Okay, say more about it. Okay, you can. Are you a Methodist? Yes. Yes, you have to be. You have to know that phrase to be a member of the Methodist Church. You're strangely warmed heart. Yeah. Do you know how that came about? Yep. I'm going to go back just a little bit farther. Wesley tried really, really hard to be a Christian from Oxford and in his first parishes. And he thought if he worked hard enough, he could be a Christian. And somewhere along the line, he decided he wanted to be a missionary. And so he applied to go to Savannah, Georgia, to the New World. This is colonization, you know, because he was sure that he could win the noble savages and the frontier people to Christ. So he packs up his Oxford bow tie. You imagine that on the frontier, you know. And he takes a ship. I mean, it takes 6 weeks to cross the Atlantic. He lands in Savannah, and he becomes the rector of the church in Savannah. And if you ever go to, anybody been to Savannah? Yeah, there's all kinds of statues of Methodist stuff in the city squares. I mean, it's pretty well known down there. color, and he's with Frontiersmen. Now, it's very British, Savannah, at that time. And what Colleen and I found out, we didn't know this part of it. We knew he didn't have success there, but we weren't sure why. Here's what happened. He fell in love with this girl, and her... I didn't know that. Server communion, and her dad was furious. Away from the altar rail and wouldn't serve her. Clinically. And she went off with some other guy. And he wouldn't serve her. And her dad got so angry, he wanted to have him kicked out of the whole country. So what? From the mayor of Savannah. So things were all shaky after that. And he finally got on a boat. He was really discouraged. In the 6 weeks back to England, he's like in depression. He thinks I'm not spiritual at all. And in one of the cabins, and these Moravians had something he didn't have. He realized he had worked so hard at being a Christian from a perspective of good works, but these Moravians had a faith and a deep trust in God. In fact, they hit a lot of storms on the Atlantic. You imagine those old wooden boats up and down like that. And these Moravians were calm. In fact, they were singing hymns during storms. And he's like, whatever they have, that's what I need. I'm missing that piece. So that's the backdrop of Aldersgate. He gets back to London, and he's still like trying to figure out, what do they have I don't have, and I can't go on. He's walking through the streets one night, and he stops at this road, if you see a road sign, Aldersgate, and the church is not there anymore, but they still have a street sign, Aldersgate, and a statue, a monument of what happened there. He goes into the church. The reader up front is reading the preface to the book of Romans written by Martin Luther about how you are saved by faith alone, not by all your works. And it's like at that moment, the Holy Spirit just said, that's what you need. You need faith alone. You need to just put your trust in Jesus. It's not because of all your good works. And that's where he wrote what Mary June just said. He wrote in his journal, I felt my heart was strangely warmed that night. So that's really the beginning of a real relationship with God moment for him. And it's really when the Methodist revival started to go, because he couldn't wait. Tell other people what happened. It was shortly after that he got a call from the other side of England. If you've ever been there, Bristol is over on the coast. And a guy named George Whitfield was over there, and he said, John, you got to come over here right away. I'm preaching to hundreds and hundreds of coal miners. Bristol's where the industry was and the coal mining. And I'm preaching out in the open fields. He sends this message. And Wesley thought it was a sin to ever preach outside the church walls. Yeah, that's the religion he had been brought up in. He's like, you can't do that. So he gets on his horse and rides over to Bristol, and he lectures Whitfield about preaching walls. And Whitfield's like, oh, I don't know, John, because the church doesn't really want these people. They're dirty. They're coal miners. They come up at night out of the mines. They work 7 days a week, but they're hungry for the gospel. And in one day, Wesley changed his mind. It took him 24 hours, and God changed him. So we got to stand up on a hill that's called the Mount of something. I can't remember. And the people would gather on the hillside down below. And Wesley would preach to them. He said, the first night, he said, I preached to 3,000 people. I mean, it's amazing. And people were giving their hearts to Christ, and the Church of England didn't want them. These are peasants. They weren't educated. And so that's how the Methodist revival started. John's like, what do I do with all these people? Get them into church. They don't want them. I'll organize them into small groups. So he really became the master organizer of small group ministry. It's not a new thing, you know. I mean, it does go back to the book of Acts, but it got lost for a lot of years. And Wesley organized what he called societies, big giant groups, and then bands, home groups, and he had like three or four different levels. And people began discipled, and you can see how the Methodist movement really flourished was because lay people like you guys were the leaders of these bands. They didn't have a whole bunch of professional clergy. In fact, this is an interesting fact. I hope I'm not boring you with a bunch of history, but I got to try to remember. Between 1780, I think, and 1850 in this country, the Methodist Church grew to 13,000 congregations in those years. After 1850, they started a decline. And people want to know why the decline happened here, and that's when they started professional clergy have to be part of it. When the Methodist movement was lay people doing Bible studies together and prayer groups and sharing, you know, doing works of charity in the community, it was on fire. When we got professional about it, it started to die. I forgot my numbers, but the slope downward is dramatic from this high. One third of the United States was Methodist at one moment. And as soon as the professional clergy got involved, it started going the other direction. So take heart. Anyway, I like to say that one last thing. At Cornerstone, we've been able to launch two other campuses in Grand Rapids, and we're hoping to do more. But we don't go to the bishop and say, please send us a clergy person. We look for people in our own church that God's moved in their hearts, because we believe so strongly in recovering this ministry of the laity that you can train a person to become a pastor, you know. We look for men or women who are feeling some kind of call to ministry, and both of our campuses have a campus pastor that had experiences at our church first. And have been there for 6 or 7 years, you know. And God's called them into ministry. So they're doing great. They're preaching live every single Sunday. And their churches, both of them are growing. Both of those campuses started with 100 people, and they're both almost 400 now. And so I'm a big believer in the ministry of lay people. So go, Charles. Right.
PUB, Free Methodist, all at that point in time, those 15, 20 years. And where they come back together, they often have two Methodist churches on opposite corners, one north and one south. Historically. Yeah. And she's been in Arcata. She's amazed at the number of Methodist churches we have.
Yep. Well, in the 1860s, a group of people in New York said, those Southern Methodists aren't condemning slavery fast enough, and so we're going to break off and call ourselves the Wesleyan Methodists. And that's how the Wesleyans got started. They never rejoined. It's its own denomination. Free Methodists, because when the Methodists first came from England, they practiced the same practice of England, of the Episcopal Church. They didn't take offerings. You paid church rent on your family pew. In fact, if you go to Philadelphia right now and you visit Christ Episcopal Church, where George Washington attended, you'll see the Washington family pew. They had to pay rent, and that's how the church collected revenue. And so this group called a Free Methodist said, church ought to be free. And so they broke off, and that's how the Free Methodist started. And then everybody went to offerings instead of church rent. So it didn't matter, but there was already a split. Yeah.
So all the divide that you're talking about, and I love the history, because you just told me things I hadn't really known before, but with all that divide, how do you see the church going back towards what John Wesley and the founding men of Methodists see it as? Because I don't think they saw it as five different fragmented congregations. How does that pull back together? Or how do you see that? How would you think that looks pulling that back together?
Thank you, Mark. That's a segue into the last section here.
I did not know that.
Yes, he did know it. He did know it. It's a, he's a plant in the audience. No. Honestly, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm more concerned about spiritual awakening than I am about everybody being part of the same. You know, America is just weird anyway, because Americans have always had this concept that if you don't like it, you can move west. That's in our roots. Honestly, that goes back to the roots of this country. You don't like it? Move west. Get your own plot of ground. Move west. Start your own colony. Start your own city. And so that has affected church life in America. If you don't like it, start your own church. And so we have all these different splits, where Europe didn't do it that way. You couldn't move west in Europe, you know. It was landlocked and space locked. And so it didn't have that concept of start. So there was a more of a unified one Church of England, one, you know, that sort of thing. But America has been affected by that frontier thinking for hundreds of years, actually. So, how do you mind the gap? Let's come back to that. How do you keep alert spiritually? What are the things? What? Yeah, Mary? But it was there that you really feel like you dug it. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. That's also a segue into this next part. Thank you, Mary. I think what you saw happening there was another one of those movements of God. You know, there are places in history you can look back on. Hundreds of thousands of people suddenly getting connected with God through a movement that Halverson started. Yeah. Wesley said, in order for people to not have this gap between Jesus Christ is looking, or their life looking more like his and living down here, to mind that gap, he said, what we need is to practice what he called means of grace. A means of grace is just a way for God to work through something, God's Spirit, in order to keep you close to God. So what are the means of grace? For the Wesleyan movement, historically, and I think we've gotten a long way from this, as Mary June said. But Wesley said, first one is prayer. He practiced and encouraged everybody in these small groups to begin every day with conversation with God. He said it's as essential as breathing. In Mark chapter 1, you know, Jesus did this very early in the morning while it was still dark. Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. So Wesley said, we've got to be like Jesus. And so you've got to create time in your day, not just driving your car to work, or, you know, I know those are all okay times too, but there's got to be time where you're quiet and where God can speak to you and you can talk to God and have conversation back and forth. The second one is Bible study. You do pray, I know. You combine those two, and you probably do a lot of these things in there. Wesley rode his horse about 250,000 miles in his lifetime. Yeah. Same horse, yeah. He died at the end, I don't know. But he really refined the art of, because horses don't move fast. He read his Bible while he rode. And he formed sermons in his mind and, you know, a lot of that stuff. Jesus said, if you continue in my word, you will be my disciples indeed. And you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. So he challenged these early Methodists to get a Bible reading plan. Not just a devotional book. I find in my church everybody wants to read Jesus Calling. And it's a great little devotional book, but it's not enough. You kind of need to get into the Word of God yourself. You need to study it, read it. Even if you don't understand it all, God speaks to you through the Word. The third thing that Wesley said, and he had seven of these, prayer, Bible study, journaling. He really encouraged people to have a journal and to write down what God said to them in the Word, or, you know, different incidents that happen in your daily life that you see God at work. Write them down. That's what he did in his journal. I feel my heart strangely warmed. Colleen and I both journal, not every single day, but, you know, several days a week maybe. We write down prayers so we can look back and go, did God answer that? You know, it's funny, when you look back through prayers, you think, wow, I forgot I'd even prayed for that. And look what happened, you know. It's a pretty cool thing. So if you don't have a journal, I'd encourage you to start one. And even if you just read a few verses a day, just say, is God speaking to me through that? Make a note, write it down. A fourth one is fasting. Have any of you tried fasting? Yeah. What's been your experience? Sorry. Excuse me, I just dumped my coffee all over my shirt. Yeah.
Or spilling your coffee on your shirt.
Yeah. That's on the Monday Musings recording right now. Excuse me.
Yeah,
you begin to focus. Right.
It's very, very powerful. And what I've experienced is that the devil wants to keep you from all of that list that you just went through, including fasting, particularly because it is so powerful. And it's just interesting to observe in your life when you want to become more like Jesus and then you really get into a spiritual warfare.
So, it's interesting that Jesus almost always talked about prayer with fasting. When you fast, when you pray. In the Sermon on the Mount, when you give, when you fast, when you pray. As if it's just part of the Christian life. And some of us give, most of us pray, a lot of us skip fasting. Now, I know a lot of people are on various kind of meds and you have to be careful of all that. I get all that. But Colleen and I have had a good experience with a partial fast called a Daniel fast. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. Daniel eats just certain foods for 21 days, and turns out he gets healthier and sharper than all the king's people that are eating rich foods. And so there's all kinds of websites on the Daniel fast now, and you can do that. But we like to start the year.